Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everybody. And now three guests to describe how things actually are for regular people in Syria while the world leaders debate the politics of chemical weapons. Oliver Holmes is a Reuters reporter based in Beirut. He's traveled to Syria a number of times and continues to report on the region. Lena Attar is a Syrian-American architect with family from the northern city of Aleppo. She's the co-founder and president of Karam Foundation, a nonprofit dedicated to providing humanitarian and medical aid to Syrians. She joins us from Chicago. And Maitha Al-Hassan is a Syrian-American PhD candidate at USC, University of Southern California, who writes frequently about the war and its effects on both Syrians and the Syrian diaspora. She has also worked as an Al Jazeera digital producer and anchor. Welcome to all three of you to WNYC. Thank you so much for giving us some time today. And can we just start with a naive question, but one I bet others have too. When I look at the map of the location of the chemical weapons attack on August 21st, it's a neighborhood just on the eastern edge of Damascus. So, Oliver, these attacks are happening in a crowded city. But to the residents of Damascus, do they feel like they're happening in sort of one particular contained area? Or is the threat of attack looming over the entire city as people experience their day-to-day lives?
No, people believe that the effects of the chemical weapon attacks that happened on August 21st and alleged attacks that had happened beforehand on a smaller scale affect not just the neighborhoods in the east that were hit, but also some neighborhoods in the west that were hit. And people who are living in government-held areas of Damascus are saying that they fear the effects of sarin that can be passed into water, into the air. Maybe it could get into the fruit and vegetables that is predominantly produced in areas where the chemical attacks were hit before. So people everywhere in Damascus are worried about the effects of these chemical weapon use.
Now, the UN has released a report that says all the evidence points to an attack conducted by the military. They cite the amount of gas, the quality of the sarin, the angle of attack that points to the rockets originating from a military stronghold. But here is Assad in an interview co-conducted yesterday by, of all people, Denis Kucinich on, of all places, Fox News. Here is Assad's response on the question of evidence.
Yeah, we have to discuss the evidence with them. We have to discuss it with them because they are coming back. They haven't finished their mission yet. They are coming back, and we have to discuss it with them. We have to see the details. But we cannot disagree without having the opposite evidence. You cannot build a report on videos if it's not verified.
But they are basing it on the blood sample.
Especially as we live in a world of forgery for the last 2.5 years regarding Syria. You have a lot of forgery on the internet.
So that's Assad's version, which very few other people believe. But Maitha Al-Hassan, can I ask you, how are Syrians viewing this message? Do you think there's still lingering doubt among Syrians over Assad's own willingness to use chemical weapons? Is this an active debate in the populace in Syria, as far as you could tell?
Wow, that's a difficult question because you're obviously talking about a country of 20 million people, and Assad does still have some supporters in the country. And there are people who have been consistently against him, so they are not surprised that assigning blame to him and his regime for using chemical, or assigning blame to him and his regime to for the use of chemical weapons is something not outside of the realm of possibilities for them. In terms of waiting for a UN response or an international community response, I don't know if people are holding out. I think people are actually more so upset that the international community is so concerned about the use of chemical weapons when conventional weapons have been killing people daily, and they've been killing 140,000 people versus the 1,400. So they actually feel like the value of their life or the value of a Syrian life in international eyes is worthless because it just mattered that they were killed through chemical weapons in these geopolitical debates.
Lena Attar, how much do you agree with that? Do you think Syrians think it's even that important to find out who used these weapons at the level that the international community is focusing on it as opposed to other problems?
No, I agree with Maisa. I think that the use of chemical weapons in most Syrian people's eyes is in the hands of the regime, just as most of the killing that has been happening over the last 2.5 years has been at the hands of the regime. But we are very upset as Syrians that the narrative in the media has shifted completely to a discussion on chemical weapons and how to destroy them and how to negotiate with Assad on these chemical weapons, when none of the discussion is happening on how to create a ceasefire, how to end the violence, how to return 7 million displaced and Syrian refugees back to their homes. That discussion is not happening at all. And in the last week or so, since this issue has become the major concern, over 1,000 people have been killed in Syria, and nobody's talking about that.
Through other means.
Yes.
And can I add something, too? I think what inside Syria, what people were very upset about was the hesitation on the part of the U.S. to throw out the threat of a strike 2 weeks in advance, or to have this discussion float around the air for the past 2 years, whether or not the U.S. was interested in intervening, because they felt like their hopes were raised, or that it gave the Assad regime time to, you know, find diplomatic means or to move around his chemical weapons.
Now, listeners, we can also crowdsource this discussion. Are any Syrian Americans listening right now who have a reaction yourselves, or maybe have contact with friends or family in Syria and want to report not just on the chemical weapons debate, but much more broadly on conditions on the ground? What are you hearing about regular life in Syria? What do you know that you can tell us that the rest of our listeners should know? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And what would you like to see done? 212-433-9692, as we talk with our three guests. And Oliver Holmes in Beirut, how are residents getting news within the country? Are they watching state-run TV? If so, does that report accurately? Can they access the internet? Is it mostly word of mouth? How do Syrians know beyond their block what's going on in this war?
They watch all the media you're talking about. They have Syrian state TV, which even people who support the government know is hugely biased in favor of the government, and very, very rarely reports, if ever, on any government abuses in the war. They're very, very tech-savvy people I speak to. I have lots of Syrian friends who I speak to in other sources as well, who use Facebook, Twitter. Often a lot of our reporting is done via Skype. But also in many areas of the country, you know, news is passed around through word of mouth, especially in the villages and in sort of rural areas. But absolutely, they get information from all different sources, and people know that the bias of the different sources. They know when they read state media that a lot of it will be propaganda, and they know when they read Western media that it will have a Western point of view as well. So several sources.
Maitha, since you've worked for Al Jazeera, which I know is not pulling its punches on this story, is Al Jazeera available in Syria? It's obviously designed to broadcast to the greater Arab world. Can people receive it there?
The government hasn't really been able to control satellite stations and the access to stations all over the world. So I'm not specifically sure if everybody can get Al Jazeera, but this is kind of beyond the government control of media mm-hmm. dissemination. And, you know, to echo Oliver's points, I think people in the region, especially in Syria, have always been savvy about what kind of money or government is backing a station and their political views and desires and intentions. So something like Al Jazeera, they know, has a Qatari bend, and their interest in the region is very obvious with the way that they were reporting Syria, Libya, Egypt. And same thing as Al Arabiya, another station we don't talk about, is a Saudi-owned station.
Indeed, and we had a guest from there earlier in the week. And Lena Attar as someone who has family in Aleppo, you know, we discuss the fighting within the country, we discuss the millions of refugees, but I wonder, are there residents of Damascus or Aleppo or Syrians elsewhere who are not affected by the conflict, where life continues in whatever you might call a normal way?
I don't think that anybody has been spared from whatever's going on, no matter who you are. There are stories of people trying to continue on with life. People do go to schools, do go to universities, but there is no normal in Syria right now, whoever you are or wherever you live. Obviously, depending from area to area, even inside a place like Aleppo, that differs. And to add to your last question about media, I mean, there's lots of areas in Aleppo and in villages that don't have access to internet or phone landlines or cell phones or electricity. So, you know, being cut off from your basic necessities also affects how well connected you are to what's going on in the rest of the country.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. As we try to hear what's happening with the Syrian people as the politicians and the world leaders debate the war from 30,000 feet, as we have three guests, two Syrian Americans and Oliver Holmes, a Reuters reporter in Beirut. And let's take a phone call. Rena in Short Hills. You're on WNYC. Hello, Rena.
Yes, hi. I was living in Damascus up until 2011, and I still keep in touch with all my friends and family who are still there. And from what I hear, it's just that the sounds of gunfire and bombs and shelling is common everywhere in the city right now. We used to be in the what was called the Green Zone, where everything was kind of safe. It was the more affluent area in Damascus, but now it's just become, you know, just constant shelling. They say they hear over thousands of bullets per day. And my big comment is just that I'm not quite understanding why the entire campaign for international support for military action has to be so complicated. When they went to take out some of the mud, and they sent in a small team of SEALs, and they took them out, and it was over pretty quickly. And I'm just not understanding why that's not on the table, why that's not being discussed. I mean, just to take out the major players, and that would be the beginning of the end of the war. I mean, I understand that after that happens, it's going to be a very long-term civil war that happens, but then we can at least start the beginning of that process.
Well, a couple of things about that, Rena. One, of course, as I'm sure you know, many Americans feel burned by what happened in Iraq, where 10 years ago we were promised by the Bush administration that that would be pretty quick and painless. And what they were really telling us was that it would be pretty quick and painless to get Saddam Hussein out of power, which it was. But then the civil war started there in earnest, and what a mess it became. Colin Powell had articulated the "you broke it, you bought it" rule, which, you know, if we destroy the existing order there, then we're responsible for staying with many troops and helping to establish the new order. And even beyond that, many people say, well, it's, you know, it's not legal for the United States to decide that they don't like a particular leader and send in a SEAL team to assassinate him, Osama bin Laden notwithstanding, as a private citizen. What do you think about any of those things?
Well, first of all, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, and to just have someone have someone killed without due diligence, I completely agree. I don't necessarily think that that person needs to be taken out. I mean, just be taken to the side and sent to the International Criminal Court. I think that needs to start, that process needs to start, and I think it needs to start on both sides. I think both sides are now guilty of a lot of war crimes, and a lot of people need to be investigated and questioned, that's for sure. But no matter what, the president needs to be removed and needs to be taken off, and the process of the transition needs to start. And I agree with you. When Saddam Hussein came out, the process and the civil war had to start, but it has to end. But that transition needs to happen once the absence of the dictator mm-hmm. is removed. And
right.
that, yeah.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate
Thank
your
you.
Voice on this as a Syrian American in New Jersey and somebody with family there and who's lived there and obviously very, very concerned. And so Lena Attar, co-founder and president of Karam Foundation, a not-for-profit dedicated to providing humanitarian and medical aid to Syrians. Do you relate to Rena's call? Do you also think, whether you feel like you can say this from a soapbox all the time or not, why don't they just send in the damn SEALs and take Assad out and get rid of the guy, and we'll work it out from there?
Absolutely, and this question is not something that should be discussed now. It should have been discussed over a year and a half ago. The analogy to Iraq is not a correct one. I know a lot of Americans see this as, oh my God, this is another Iraq, whereas this country has already been destroyed. We have lost over 100,000 people. A third of the country is displaced, and it's already broken. And Syrians never asked for boots on the ground. They never asked for that type of military intervention. And there was a point in the war where Assad started bombing cities with planes, and that was a point where the international community should have stopped and said, this has to stop, and we need to ground his air force and at least create a no-fly zone for the FSA to be able to communicate with each other, form a unified command, to be able to bring in the political opposition from outside Syria to inside Syria, and to start that process. And unfortunately, we're over a year and a half late into that.
Now, here's another clip of Assad. This is from his interview with Charlie Rose of CBS and PBS last week, discussing how he sees himself viewed within the country.
First question that I ask, do I have public support or not? Whether there's Arab, what's the so-called Arab Spring, it's not Spring anyway, but whether we have this or we don't, if you don't have public support, you have to quit, you have to leave. If you have public support in any circumstances, you have to stay. It's been 2 years and a half, okay? 2 years and a half, and Syria is still withstanding against the United States, the West, Saudi Arabia, the richest country in this area, including Turkey. And taking into consideration what your question implies, that even the big part or the bigger part of the Syrian population against me, how can I withstand till today? I'm either superhuman or Superman, which is not the case.
Bashar al-Assad with Charlie Rose last week. Oliver Holmes, Reuters reporter in Beirut, who's been in and out of Syria, he characterizes himself as politically popular because otherwise he couldn't stay in power. Obviously, that's his spin. But how true is it that this is a civil war with multiple factions and Assad does have a sizable amount of popular support among Alawites, if that's the right way to look at it, or in some segments of the population? And it's not just the brutal dictator oppressing all the people. It's faction against faction, and he leads one major faction.
Absolutely, Assad does have supporters, and we speak to his supporters. But I just want to say about what he told Charlie Rose about how he would not be able to stay in power if he didn't have a lot of popular support within Syria, because, you know, he doesn't have huge, huge amounts of support in Syria. The dynamic of the war is that Syria is now being run by various different militia, and the government is the biggest militia. And most Syrian civilians who you speak to want an end to the war. And it's not about popular support for a leader. A leader can rule a country without having popular support, especially in Syria, where there is the rule of fear and there is the rule of the gun only, and civilians are left to the side. But absolutely, Alawites and other minority groups within Syria are very, very worried. They've been told via state media, and they've seen videos of various rebel atrocities being carried out, and they're worried about what will happen to them. So I don't know what their motives could be, but maybe out of fear, people are supporting the army staying in the areas, other pro-Assad militia, and they say that these people are protecting them against the rebel attacks.
And so Maitha Alhassan, a Syrian-American PhD candidate at USC who writes frequently about the war and has worked for Al Jazeera, what about Assad's statement about the Arab Spring, that he sees himself as having resisted this wave of what he characterizes as U.S. intervention and Western and Saudi intervention?
Assad's rhetoric would and does appeal to anybody who is anti-imperialist or anti-American. And the fact that he was able to pretty much win on this diplomatic solution between Obama and Vladimir Putin emboldened him. And it also gave him the license to stand up and say, see, I stood up to the West. I want to go back also to your last question and comment about LOE support or what sort of support Bashar al-Assad has.
Mm-hmm.
I have family in Latakia, and Latakia is traditionally kind of conceived of as an Alawi stronghold, and that's where the Ashid lineage hails from. And my family is not Alawi, but it's also got parts that are heavily mixed of Christian and Muslim and Alawi. And the sense there is, just like Oliver said, fatigue. You know, they want a ceasefire, and they actually liken it to the civil war in Lebanon, that fatigue of the fighting, and we just want anybody to come in with the ceasefire, and we want everything to return back to normal, instead of this new normal of waking up to shelling, instead of this new normal of not knowing when the electricity is going to work.
So do you think, Maitha, that represents something of a path to peace? If everybody is so exhausted, if the sides are exhausted, I don't know, maybe that just helps Assad stay in power. But I think a lot of the world has been revolted by the idea of a negotiated peace that would allow him to stay in power. But do you think that people are just tired enough that maybe that's the best solution, with some kind of restraints or even some kind of informal divisions of the country?
I think there's too much bloodshed that a negotiated peace with Assad, though, would be a solution. I know that the way that the FSA has kind of marketed themselves, there's a video out there, they showed themselves with weaponry because they've been so defiled in the media as possibly having extremist elements. They promise that they're going to put down their arms afterwards, and they show roses in their guns. And this, it was a popular symbol of a protest that was happening in the first 6 months when the uprising was nonviolent, that people would bring roses to the regime as an offer of peace. But I think there's been too much bloodshed for anybody to feel like Assad has legitimate rule right now. And, you know, people remembered when his father bombed Hama in 82 and killed who knows how many, 25,000 to 50,000. And that never left people's minds. That's why it was so easy in this moment to kind of seize the uprising in March. And also the way that the regime reacted to 6 months of peaceful protest was just another example of how the Assad regime can't be trusted, and also what sort of brutal future they had in store for them.
Let's take another call from another Syrian-American, Mohammed in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. I want to say a couple of things, which is everybody is talking about civil war in Syria, and it's not a civil war. This is a revolution, and this is a dictator, the son of a dictator, who is killing people for the last 2.5 years. Now everybody is focusing about the chemical weapons. The chemical weapons, the Syrian people, they don't want it. So let's take his chemical weapons, but at the same time, let's send them to The Hague to face trial, because this guy, I'm sure he killed more than 200,000 people. The United Nations is reporting only 120,000 people, but it's much, much more.
So you would rather see it framed as an uprising against a dictator than a civil war of faction
exactly.
against faction.
Exactly. I mean, the Syrian people, they live together, Christian, Muslims, and Jews also. We never have this problem. He created this problem now. The Alawite versus Sunni, and also they put the Christian in the middle, that telling them living in fear, telling them that if Assad goes, it means you will be killed by Muslims. And this is very wrong. I mean, we never have this problem in Syria.
Mohammed, I'm curious. For you yourself, were you skeptical of U.S. intervention in the Middle East militarily in Iraq or in other situations because you see the U.S. as maybe an imperial power or something like that, only out for its oil or support Israel or its own interests? But now you want the U.S. in this case?
In this case, definitely this is a just case to intervene because this is civilian people who's in this situation cannot defend themselves. I have a mother in Damascus, Syria, who cannot leave her house for the last 12 months. And the neighbors, they're taking care of her. She's an 80 years old, and she cannot bring bread or something to eat for herself. This is one story. And this is Damascus. We're talking about the capital. The other places is much worse.
Mohammed, my best to your mother and your whole family, and I hope everything works out for them in the long run. And I appreciate you calling in. And Maitha, let me go right back to you on this. Again, as somebody who's reported for Al Jazeera, as a PhD candidate at USC who writes frequently about the war, do you think there's an ambivalence on the part of the Syrian people about the United States or a change in attitude from other situations where they would have seen the U.S. as the imperial power who should leave this region alone already? Up until this civil war started, and now they see them as the only hope for rescue from Assad?
Well, I'll take it even personal for you, Brian.
Mm-hmm.
I am even ambivalent. I myself am usually against the idea of U.S. intervention, especially if there's no development or rebuilding plan attached to it, like there was in Bosnia and Kosovo. And subsequently after that, we kind of and funded and invested less in rebuilding countries that we intervened into. But I do know that my family and friends very, very strongly supported U.S. intervention. And, I think it is a very difficult position to be in because a lot of the people feel like, you know, it's not just requesting U.S. intervention, it's facing not only the Assad regime, but facing Russia and facing China. So they feel like they have no other sort of superpower or power outside of themselves that can come in. You know, I watch some of these videos and I see people imploring, first, Arabs, where are you? Second, Muslims, where are you? And then the third is usually the U.S., where are you? So it kind of is on this sort of scale of where are some of the partners we see who would have interest in our region? You know, and Qatar and Saudi Arabia were trying to be involved, but people felt like that sort of intervention came at a high cost. So they saw the U.S. with the military power and might to stand up to Russia and Iran as the only option.
Lena Attar, do you want to weigh in on this? I can hear the agony in Maitha's voice.
Absolutely, and people are, I would go even beyond what Maitha was saying, is that when people see this policy of inaction, this policy of isolationism that President Obama is advocating for in terms of Syria, people they're beyond disappointed with the U.S. They're actually seeing the U.S. as a partner in what's going on right now in Syria. So there is a consequence of inaction, which is people see Obama, Putin, and Assad being a three-way partnership between them with this chemical weapons agreement, and the Syrian people being the victims, the ultimate victims of this process.
Oliver, let me go to you in Beirut and ask, to Maitha's earlier point, is there not some way that countries in the region could take the military lead on this? We had the longtime critic of U.S. foreign policy, Noam Chomsky, on the program yesterday, and he was talking against U.S. intervention in Syria and saying international law doesn't really allow it without a U.N. resolution. What it does allow is countries in the region in an emergency like this to band together and make an intervention in a foreign country.
Absolutely, countries in the region could get involved. Everybody is looking towards the U.S., but two or three of the opposition's main supporters, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, could all get involved militarily. In Turkey, for example, the Syrian army has occasionally fired shells and mortars over the border into Turkey, and also their helicopters occasionally cross into Turkey, and one was shot down the other day. Turkey is a huge, huge military power in the region and part of NATO, but they haven't. Everybody has looked to the U.S. to lead on this. I think the countries in the region are very worried at going at it alone.
And Lena, I know you got to go in a minute. We all have to go in a minute, but talk before you go about Syrian refugees. I know your organization has worked with camps on the northern edge of the country, many in Turkey, but I also see on your website that you talk about IDPs, internally displaced persons, people who have had to flee their home but stay in the country. What's important for our listeners to know about the refugee situation?
What's important to know is that in Syria, there is over 5 million internally displaced people, and they are distributed all across the country. Most of them live in public buildings, in schools, in mosques, wherever they can take shelter in large groups. And Kerem Foundation has been working a lot with IDP camps, which are kind of makeshift camps that developed on the Turkish border. And because Turkey was not able to accommodate all of the Syrians fleeing from the violence into the country as refugees, so you have these camps that developed on the border, and they host almost 200,000 people combined in these camps. These people have been living in tents for a year now. They do not have access to electricity, to running water, to sanitary facilities. There are very basic schools that that accommodate a fraction of the children who are now entering their second year, their second winter in these camps. And I've been to these camps before. We created a program called Zaytuna, which we went in and did workshops for the children in Atme camp, which is home to over 20,000 IDPs. And we will be going back this December to run another program for Syrian refugees and try to get in humanitarian aid into Syria in the form of winterizing baskets like blankets, shoes, socks, medication. All of these things are going to be needed for all of these displaced people because they're facing another brutal winter.
And I do want to mention, since you said that, that we have a link on our site to your foundation for people who want to help. Well,
thank
enough
so
with the leaders in suits. There is some of the view from on the ground in Syria and from Syrian Americans. Lena Attar, who was just speaking, is an architect with family from Aleppo. She lives in Chicago and is co-founder and president of Karam Foundation, a not-for-profit dedicated to providing humanitarian and medical aid to Syrians. Maitha Al-Hassan is a Syrian-American PhD candidate at USC who writes frequently about the war and its effects on Syrians and the Syrian diaspora. She has also worked as an Al Jazeera digital producer and anchor. And Oliver Holmes, Reuters reporter based in Beirut, who has been in and out of Syria during this war. Thank you all for giving us this time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we will meet the five winners of our New York City Neighborhood Library Awards. What made their libraries great? What will they do with the $10,000 prizes they're getting? And then Miss Manners, mind your business. The actual Miss Manners, Judith Martin herself. So stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.